For a time, Nelson sought the French fleet in vain. Finally, on the evening of the 1st of August, he found it, at anchor in Aboukir Bay. He had caught it unawares. Many of the men were ashore, and a council was being held in the flagship. He had no charts, and it was a hazardous thing to sail into the shallow water in a bad light. The French admiral concluded, therefore, that his adversary would not attack before morning, and so made no haste in recalling his men aboard until it was too late to do so. Nelson, however, struck at once against the advice of some of his captains. One ship only went aground. She marked the shoal for the rest of the fleet. He sailed to the attack in a double line about sundown, putting the French between two fires. Night fell as the battle was joined. The fight thundered and crashed in the darkness until it was lit presently by the flames of burning French ships, and then by the flare of the French flagship, the Orient, blowing up. Before midnight, the Battle of the Nile was over, and Napoleon's fleet was destroyed. Napoleon was cut off from France. Says Holland Rose, quoting Thiers, this Egyptian expedition was the rashest attempt history records. Napoleon was left in Egypt with the Turks gathering against him and his army infected with the plague. Nevertheless, with a stupid sort of persistence, he went on for a time with this eastern scheme. He gained a victory at Jaffa, and, being short of provisions, massacred all his prisoners. Then he tried to take Acre, where his own siege artillery, just captured at sea by the English, was used against him. Returning baffled to Egypt, he gained a brilliant victory over a Turkish force at Aboukir, and then, deserting the army of Egypt, it held on until 1801, when it capitulated to a British force, made his escape back to France in 1799, narrowly missing capture by a British cruiser off Sicily. Here was muddle and failure enough to discredit any general, had it been known. But the very British cruisers, which came so near to catching him, helped him by preventing any real understanding of the Egyptian situation from reaching the French people. He could make a great flourish over the Battle of Aboukir and conceal the shame and loss of Acre. Things weren't going well with France just then. There had been military failures at several points. Much of Italy had been lost, Bonaparte's Italy, and this turned men's minds to him as the natural saviour of that situation. Moreover, there had been much peculation, and some of it was coming to light. France was in one of her phases of financial scandal, and Napoleon hadn't filched. The public was in that state of moral fatigue when a strong and honest man is called for, a wonderful, impossible, healing man who'll do everything for everybody. People, poor lazy souls, persuaded themselves that this specious young man with the hard face so providentially back from Egypt was the strong and honest man required. Another Washington. With Julius Caesar, rather than Washington, at the back of his mind, Napoleon responded to the demand of his time. A conspiracy was carefully engineered to replace the Directory by three consuls. Everybody seems to have been reading far too much Roman history just then, of whom Napoleon was to be the chief. The working of that conspiracy is too intricate a story for our space. It involved a Cromwell-like dispersal of the lower house, the Council of 500, and in this affair Napoleon lost his nerve. The deputies shouted at him and hustled him, and he seems to have been very much frightened. He nearly fainted, stuttered, and could say nothing. But the situation was saved by his brother, Lucien, who brought in the soldiers and dispersed the council. This little hitch didn't affect the final success of the scheme. The three consuls were installed at the Luxembourg Palace, with two commissioners, to reconstruct the constitution. With all his confidence restored, and sure of the support of the people who supposed him to be honest, patriotic, republican, and able to bring about a good peace, Napoleon took a high hand with his colleagues and the commissioners. A constitution was produced in which the chief executive officer was to be called the First Consul, with enormous powers. He was to be Napoleon. This was part of the constitution. He was to be re-elected or replaced at the end of 10 years. He was to be assisted by a council of state appointed by himself, which was to initiate legislation and send its proposal to two bodies, the legislative body, which could vote but not discuss, and the tribunate, which could discuss but not vote, which was selected by an appointed senate from a special class, the notabilities of France, who were elected by the notabilities of the departments, who were elected by the notabilities of the commune, who were elected by the common voters. The suffrage for the election of the notabilities of the commune was universal. This was the sole vestige of democracy in the astounding pyramid. This constitution was chiefly the joint production of a worthy philosopher, Sieyès, who was one of the three consuls, and Bonaparte. But so weary was France with her troubles and efforts, and so confident were men in the virtue and ability of this adventurer from Corsica, that when, at the birth of the 19th century, this constitution was submitted to the country, it was carried by 3,011,007 votes to 1,562. France put herself absolutely in Bonaparte's hands, and prepared to be peaceful, happy, and glorious. Third. Now, surely here was an opportunity such as never came to man before. Here was a position in which a man might well bow himself in fear of himself, and search his heart and serve God and man to the utmost. The old order of things was dead or dying. Strange new forces drove through the world, seeking form and direction. The promise of a world republic and an enduring world peace whispered in a multitude of startled minds. Had this man any profundity of vision, any power of creative imagination, had he been accessible to any disinterested ambition, he might have done work for mankind that would have made him the very sun of history. All Europe and America, stirred by the first promise of a new age, was waiting for him. Not France alone. France was in his hand, his instrument, to do with as he pleased, willing for peace, but tempered for war like an exquisite sword. There lacked nothing to this great occasion but a noble imagination. And failing that, Napoleon could do no more than strut upon the crest of this great mountain of opportunity like a cockerel on a dunghill. The figure he makes in history is one of almost incredible self-conceit, of vanity, greed, and cunning, of callous contempt and disregard of all who trusted him, and of a grandiose aping of Caesar, Alexander, and Charlemagne, which would be purely comic if it weren't caked over with human blood. Until, as Victor Hugo said in his tremendous way, God was bored by him, and he was kicked aside into a corner to end his days, explaining and explaining how very clever his worst blunders had been, prowling about his dismal hot island, shooting birds and squabbling meanly with an underbred jailer who failed to show him proper respect. His career as First Consul was perhaps the least dishonorable phase in his career. He took the crumbling military affairs of the Directory in hand, and after a complicated campaign in North Italy, brought matters to a head in the victory of Marengo, near Alessandria, in 1800. It was a victory that at some moments became very near disaster. In the December of the same year, General Moreau, in the midst of snow, mud, and altogether abominable weather, inflicted an overwhelming defeat upon the Austrian army at Hohenlinden. If Napoleon had gained this battle, it would have counted among his most characteristic and brilliant exploits. These things made the hoped-for peace possible.